happen everywhere.
Hello, my name's Pete Goddard, and I'm here in the HHE studio with the sunspot to my solar flare. It's Mr. Ryan Weir.
That's right, Peter. Put on your SPF 50, because I'm coming in hot.
Last week, the Dursalator gave us, for episode 87, topic of hotspots on the sun during 1957 to 1975, which everyone knows is the space age.
The space age.
So have you got some space for us today, and is it hot stuff?
I have indeed, Peter, because in this episode of HHE, we are turning our attention to space, and in particular, that cosmic light bulb at the heart of our solar system. We are going to turn our home star inside out, looking for the hottest, trendy, and most notable things about it. We're going to pull back the page to reveal the sensation that shocked a nation, and we'll take a stroll down memory lane in the company of a horny 18-year-old boy. That's right, it's hotspots on the sun during 1957 to 1975. Welcome to the great fiery ball in the sky. Welcome to the celestial furnace. Welcome to the sun.
Let the sun shine in, the sun shine in.
That's right, Ryan. Well, I said the Dursalator gave us this topic, but in fact it was of your own doing, was it not?
It was indeed. I chose the sun. Was that a good idea?
Yes, I am confident you're going to find something fascinating and interesting. But first, you have to orient us, although I'm guessing up is part of the directions here. Where are we, Ryan? Why don't you tell us?
Well, let's start with the name. Officially, the name of our home star is the Sun, but it's also referred to by its Latin name, Sol, which is, of course, where we get the name the solar system. Now, finding the Sun, Pete, as you asked, is pretty straightforward. Head outside on a clear day, look up, and it's going to be the most prominent thing you're going to see in the sky. Just don't look at it directly.
If I can clarify that, given that we are based in England, that's not necessarily the case on many days.
But I did for say most a patients, clear day. Yeah, that's right. Well, look, more specifically, the Sun, or Sol, lies at the centre of the solar system, which is approximately 93 million miles or 150 million kilometres from Earth. In terms of size, the Sun has a surface area of about 6 trillion 90 billion square kilometres. That's 2.35 trillion square miles. So you're going to need around 11 million Frances to completely tile the entire surface area.
Wow, that's huge.
Now, there is no population on the Sun, Pete.
Do we know that for a fact?
Yes, presumably all the native peoples burned up quite early. Now, that means there is no official religion on the Sun either, although there have been many religions and cultures on Earth which have worshipped the Sun, including but not limited to the ancient Egyptians, the Hindus, the Aztec, and the Inca. There is no official anthem for the Sun either, Pete. Didn't have a great deal of luck with this section, I'll be honest. But although sound waves cannot travel through the vacuum of space, we do know that the Sun is incredibly noisy. There's a whole bunch of gas movements and magnetic activity on the Sun's surface, which create vibrations, which can be converted into sound waves, and those sound waves turned into solar music. So while it's unlikely to ever sort of top the charts, Pete, this is my nomination for the anthem of the Sun. I call it Sunbeam, because that's what my dad used to call me, and it sounds a little something like this.
Oh, not what I would have called tuneful.
Yeah.
A little bit frightening, actually, I would say.
Yeah, it is unsettling to say the least, I would say. Now, this is sound that was captured by the Parker Solar Probe, and it measures pressure waves in the particles that make up solar wind. It sort of measures the frequencies and the amplitudes of these pressure waves, and that is then turned into sound waves.
Well, I thought that was fascinating, Ryan, because it reminds me, I remember reading online somewhere, and one of the things that deaf people who can subsequently hear are surprised by is that the sun doesn't make a sound. So I guess they're right, because it does, and they should write to expect it. But yeah, it must be quite shocking.
I'd never heard that. That's fascinating. How about that? sun facts.
Of course. I'm ready.
Okay, so first off, the sun spins faster in the middle than at the top. So unlike the Earth, where everything sort of spins in uniform, the sun doesn't rotate just on its axis. It performs something called a differential rotation, meaning that the equator spins faster than at its poles. So if you're stood on the equator of the sun, one complete turn of the sun would take about 25 days, whereas if you were stood at the top or the bottom, it would take 35 days.
So it's sort of winding itself up.
Well, I guess so. Yeah, I guess kind of. Yeah.
Is it not twisted?
Yeah, you'd think so.
I need more information on this.
Right, the other thing, Pete, is the sun has a smell.
No. Is it burning nostril hair?
Yeah, now obviously we can't smell through the vacuum of space, but scientists do think that heavy metals in the sun's super hot atmosphere smell like hot steel. So were we hypothetically able to get ourselves right in front of the sun and remove our helmet and sniff it, it would smell like hot metal.
Well, if I can't smell the sun, I know I have very poor sense of smell, but if the whole of the sun isn't enough to break through, then there's no hope for me, is there?
I'm thinking some sort of perfume or aftershave called hot steel. Anyway, yes. Right. Now, my last fact for you, Pete, is that one day it will rain on the sun.
Ooh.
Yeah, well, apparently the atmospheres of cooler, dying stars eject their outer layers, at which point carbon atoms clump together, forming tiny diamonds, which then rain back down onto the surface of the star. So when our star starts to die, it's going to do exactly the same. So we could get rich.
I was going to say, that's a perfect good news, bad news situation, isn't it? Good news, lots of diamonds are now available. Less good news, the sun is dying.
Anyway, there you go. That's all the facts I've got.
I liked it very much.
I hope you're oriented.
Very much so. All I was going to say was look up. So you've expanded my knowledge greatly.
Hey, Pete.
Hey, oh my God, what happened to you?
What do you mean?
Your face, it's glowing.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
No, not in a good way.
Really? It's not that bad, is it?
Yes, it's that bad. You look like a radioactive lobster. What have you been doing?
Oh, well, I was topping up my tan on the sunbed. I wanted to look sun-kissed.
Sun-kissed? More like you and the sun went all the way and then some. How long are you in there?
I don't know. An hour? I had a little nap.
An hour? No wonder you're bright red. Cars are stopping outside waiting for you to turn green.
Oh, it's not that bad.
Ryan, you're redder than an angry communist radish in a Santa suit.
Well, I mean, I guess I am a bit sore.
A bit sore? You're the definition of if looks could grill.
Hey, I paid good money for this tan, so I'm going to make the most of it.
How high yourself out of the warning beacon?
Oh, come on.
There are planes altering flight paths overhead.
A little aloe vera and I'll be fine.
Aloe vera? You don't need aloe vera. You need, please God, help me Vera.
Hey, I'm in enough pain as it is, Pete. I don't need you roasting me too.
Good point. You look like you've been thoroughly roasted already.
Oh, very funny.
You're right. Sorry, man. Can I get you anything to make it better? Fire extinguisher?
That is it. I am leaving.
Wait. Don't go. I need you here.
Really?
Yeah. I need somewhere to dry these towels. Hold your arm out for me.
God, I am so angry with you right now.
Really? It's just that it's kind of hard to tell. Okay, Ryan, I know where it is. I know where to look. But what is the history of the sun? What's happened up there?
Okay, so in the Milky Way, about 4.5 billion years ago, Pete, there is a cold, dense, giant cloud of molecular dust and gas. Now, this cloud is suddenly hit by the unexpected shockwave of an exploding star. The cloud spins and flattens into a disc shape, with gas and dust being pulled into the center, where there's a whole bunch of pressures that cause them to get increasingly hot and dense. This mass gets bigger as more and more gas and dust continues to fall into the center, and temperatures rise to the point that the core now reaches a temperature of around 15 million degrees Celsius.
Whew.
That is hot.
Take a fan.
Hotter than my air fryer. Now, every second, 600 million tons of hydrogen converts into helium and huge amounts of energy are released. So much energy, in fact, that the force of gravity is counteracted and the mass in the center of that disk stabilizes and the early sun is born.
Early sun! I like that! It's a new character.
Anyway, while early sun is being formed, all the remaining gas and dust, which hadn't been sucked into the sun sun's core, starts to form a system of planets and asteroids, which then get pulled around the early sun by immense gravity. In most cases, these planets are either cooked or frozen, depending on how close or how far away they are from early sun. But one of these planets, the third rock from the sun, finds itself in the fortunate position of being locked into a region where the heat from the sun is sufficient to allow water to not freeze or evaporate. And thanks to this liquid water, around 4 billion years ago, life begins to form.
And who now, was this plucky planet?
Yes, so these early life forms, they start to use the light from the sun as their source of energy, and evolution does its thing. Slime turns to fish, fish turns to lizards, lizards turn to mammals, and suddenly, early man!
Hooray!
And looking up to the sky, he notices that yellow circle, which turns night into day and helps his crops grow. He starts to praise it, holding festivals in its honour. Some early men even build monuments to align with the sun's movements. Over time, civilized man appears.
Ooh.
And yes, wearing top hats. And he starts to build more complex and more elaborate places of sun worship. In ancient Egypt, for example, pyramids are built in honor of the sun god Ra. In Mesopotamia, temples are constructed in honor of their sun god, Shamash. In South America, the Inca build temples in honor of their sun god, Inti. It's a time when we see the earliest forms of astronomy too, with Babylonians writing down the sun's movements on clay tablets, the Chinese tracking solar activity on paper, and early Greek philosophers discussing the idea that the sun was perhaps something other than a god. Now, truly scientific studies of the sun start in earnest in the first millennium, with sunspots, solar eclipses, and the solar corona being observed. This is followed by more detailed observations in the second millennium, thanks to the invention of the telescope, which kickstarted the modern art of solar astronomy. In the 19th and the 20th centuries, scientists start to develop a deeper understanding of the sun's impact on Earth, including climate change and interactions with the Earth's magnetic field. The sun is photographed for the very first time on the 2nd of April, 1845, and in 1919, Einstein sees a solar eclipse and is inspired to write his theory on general relativity, which describes the bending of light by gravity. Which brings us to the time period for today, 1957 to 1975. The Space Age!
Hurrah! Ba, 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 ba.
That's right, 18 years of the most exciting and dynamic advancements in the history of human scientific endeavour. Driven largely by the Cold War competition between the United States and Soviet Union, it starts with the launch of the world's first artificial satellite. It sees the first human travel into space, the first human spacewalk, the first humans to land on the moon, the first human to walk on the moon, and the construction of a space station. It is a time when our understanding of space completely shifts, when culture and technology changes, when the world's imagination sparks up as we consider our place in the cosmos. The sun is currently estimated to be about 4.6 billion years old, and that's, relatively speaking, middle age in its life cycle. So there's going to be plenty more generations to come that will be able to go outside and look up into the sky and marvel at that great golden orb above us.
That is an excellent introduction, Ryan, and it does always make me think, on Earth we have these challenges of energy, and yet there's this incredibly giant ball of phenomenal amounts of energy kind of just over there. One day it feels like once that's properly harnessed, boom, we could do anything.
Or, hear me out, coal and oil.
Just keep going. Keep going, there's loads of it.
We know what we're doing with that. It's fine.
Well, that was the history of the sun. Thank you, Ryan. I feel properly oriented in time and literally space.
Hurrah! Captain's log. Stardate 87 4.1.26.B. We have taken up stationary orbit 5.2 clicks from the twin suns of Galaxy Prime. Our mission to collect data on the amplified radiation. I have assigned Science Officer Kallax to join me in measuring the broad spectrum emissions.
Captain, might I make an inquiry?
Go ahead.
It is about these new uniforms, Captain.
Yes, what about them?
They appear to be what you humans call budgie smugglers.
Not just budgie smugglers, Kallax. These are Federation Speedos, for use on water planets and perhaps to top up one's tan on sun missions.
But they are very minimal. I believe the crew have been laughing at our hotspots, Captain.
Don't worry, Kallax. The crew should be busy looking at the sun, not you and I. Now, Medbay has provided this protective barrier against the threat of radiation. Let's apply it to each other.
Captain, this bottle says baby oil.
It's just a brand name, Kallax. Now, let's get it rubbed in.
If you insist, Captain.
I do. Very good, Kallax. Oh, very good.
Should we not proceed with the mission, Captain?
Mission? Oh, yeah, sure, Kallax. Turn your attention to the twin suns. Incredible orbs, aren't they?
They are certainly difficult to ignore, Captain.
Well, that's gravity for you, Kallax. That's gravity.
So, Ryan, I know where I am. I know when I am. It's time to talk about hotspots. Now, I don't think you're going to struggle to fit this theme in, but I am interested to see how you tie it back to some of the things you trailed at the beginning.
Well, look, let's start with the basics. What do we mean by the term hotspot? Well, taken literally, it refers to a small area with a temperature that is higher than everything else around it. But it's become more commonly used to refer to a place of unusual interest or significant activity. Now, sometimes that can mean referring to an area known for its danger, such as Croydon is a hotspot for knife crime.
Great example, Ryan. Thanks.
But it can also be used to single out popular places too, such as Croydon is a hotspot for buying cheap property.
Ah, well, still not brilliant. I was hoping you'd say for nightlife or something, but go on.
Yeah, I struggled to find a positive for that one. That took me a while. Now, the earliest use of the term hotspot appears around 1837 in the New Sporting Magazine, which makes me wonder what new sporting they were coming up with to need a magazine, like new sports every month.
It was a prolific time in the world of sports.
Yeah. But there it was used to refer to a dangerous situation. A year later, though, it was used in a medical document to refer to a specific skin irritation. In 1931, it was used as the nickname for a trendy nightclub in New York. And in 1938, it was used by firefighters looking to sort of pinpoint areas within a fire that are particularly dangerous. Don't go into that hotspot.
Ah.
In 1941, it becomes linked with places of international conflict, something the media still does today when it refers to hotspot war zones, for example. And in today's digital age, it's got a new understanding with millennials and Gen Z wandering into public places and connecting wirelessly to the internet on a hotspot.
Ah, yes, of course.
And I mention all of this because in today's episode, we're going to be using the term hotspot literally and figuratively as we try to link them to the sun during the space age.
Ah, well, I think you're missing one definition of hotspot that was the one I was hoping for, Ryan, which, as you know, I enjoy a long walk. And a hotspot is what you experience and the precursor to a blister on your foot. So if you could weave that in as well, that'd be great.
Right, back to my notes.
Okay, Ryan, I know what a hotspot is, but tell me about hotspots in the sun, on the sun, between here and the sun. I don't know what you're going to do. Go!
All right. So, look, let's get started with the obvious question. Are there any hotspots on the sun? Because it's pretty hot already, right?
Famously so, yes.
Yeah. And what I mean by that is, are there any areas of the sun which are hotter than the rest? But before we get into that, it's important to understand more about the makeup of the sun. So, unlike planet Earth, the sun is not a solid. Hypothetically speaking, if you could touch the surface of the sun with your hand without it instantly disintegrating, it would feel viscousy, like honey or a molten metal. And that's because, Pete, the sun is made of...
molten metal.
No.
Fire. Dragons.
Dragons? No, that was not in my research.
Gas.
Gas. Most people say the sun is made of gas, but no, it is not made of gas. It is made of plasma, which I found out to my shock is not a gas. It is actually one of four fundamental states of matter, including gas. So there's solids, liquids, gases, and then plasma. It's sometimes referred to as ionized gas, which is a fancy way of saying particles which are in rapid motion, constantly colliding with each other. That then creates an effect that makes plasma highly responsive to electromagnetic fields and is superconductive for electricity, which makes it perfect, Pete, for modern technology. You'll have seen it in use in neon lights, plasma TVs, those novelty globes where you put your hand on the glass surface and a stream of colourful electricity sort of shoots out and touches your hand.
I love them. Always wanted one of those.
We all wanted one of those. Anyway, the point is, it's awesome stuff. And the sun is made entirely out of it. So much plasma, in fact, that if you were to take all the plasma in the sun and gather it together in one lump, you would have an object that is the exact same size as the sun. It's a fun fact for you there.
Okay.
Now, there's plasma in the core of the sun, which reaches super hot temperatures, 15 million degrees, we said, 27 million degrees Fahrenheit, a heat so hot that we see it here on Earth as daylight. There's plasma in the radiative zone, which is a layer that surrounds the core and is so dense with plasma that it takes thousands of years for photons from the core to escape through it.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool. Now, there's less dense plasma in the convective zone, which is the layer above the radiative zone. There's plasma on the surface of the sun, the photosphere, and is where temperatures are much cooler. Just 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Much cooler than at the centre.
I shall take a thermos.
And a blankie. There's super hot plasma in the chromosphere and the corona as well. Those are the two layers in the sun's outer atmosphere. The point being, Pete, is that the sun is like an onion, made up of a number of layers and hot plasma.
And if you try to cut it, you will cry.
That's right. But that's not to say that there aren't other hot spots on the sun too. Most people, including me, have probably heard of sunspots, but they also probably thought that they would make interesting podcast content about hotspots until they realized that these dark circles on the surface of the sun are in reality cold spots, areas which have intense magnetic activity that transfers the heat away and lowers the temperature for just that specific part of the surface.
How can I weave this knowledge in? You thought to yourself, I have an idea.
So look, what are the other hotspots then? Well, there are parts of the sun which have especially strong magnetic fields. And sometimes these erupt into something called a solar flare. It's a blast of red-hot 10 million degree Celsius electromagnetic radiation that blows up into the sun's atmosphere. So when solar flares occur, you could count them as a hotspot on the sun. Coronal loops are hotspots too. These are arc-shaped magnetic fields which extend from active regions of the surface out into the sun's corona, and the plasma within these loops is often so superheated to the extreme, it makes them much hotter than the surface of the sun. There's also things called plages, bright and super hot regions in the chromosphere above the surface of the sun. And these are areas of increased magnetic activity that can only be observed in H alpha, don't know what that is, and ultraviolet light. I know what that is.
I concur with both of those statements.
Yeah. So those are some hot spots on the sun, Pete. Episode done.
All right, brilliant. Thanks. Yeah. Well, you've been listening to...
Yeah, but we didn't, of course, mention the time period. So, in April 1954, Pete, the sun kicked into something known as a solar cycle. Now, these were first observed in 1755, and they were called a solar cycle because they are a decade-long period where the sun's magnetic activity increases and decreases. It causes these intense variations in the number of sunspots and flares and other solar stuff. So it's a really cool time to be looking at the sun because lots of stuff is happening on it. And when 1954 rolls around, a new cycle has started. They gave this solar cycle the number 19. And boy, were they lucky, Pete, because solar cycle 19 really put on a show. During this cycle, especially around 1957 to 1958, the number of sunspots observed on the sun reached a high that has not been matched in recorded history, with the resulting solar activity causing significant geomagnetic storms on Earth. Now, that doesn't sound scary until you realise that those storms create disruptions in radio communications, they affected electrical power grids, and they increased the visibility of the aurora borealis to a point where it could be seen during the day and in places much further south and north, of course, than around the poles.
This sounds like the premise of a movie, to be honest with you.
Yeah, Solar Cycle 19, although you'd have to see all the others first, wouldn't you?
Well, that's true.
It's like the Fast and Furious franchise. Two solar, two cycle. So look, Solar Cycle 19 continued until October 1964. Now, we're actually in a solar cycle right now, Pete. We're in Solar Cycle 25.
Oh, they keep happening.
This began in December 2019 and is expected to end just before 2030. So, Pete, within the next year or so, we might expect to see some impacts from Cycle 25 here on Earth, with authorities now warning nations across the world to set up contingency plans in case solar winds overload our satellites, our power grids, and, God forbid, our cell phone networks.
I have been learning to nap Flint, so I'll be okay.
Don't take my TikTok, son, please. So there you go, Pete. Plenty of hotspots on the sun during 1957 to 1975. Now, how about we change the subject a little and talk about sexy naked women instead?
Okay, Ryan, I'm ready to talk about sexy ladies.
Let's do that after this.
Ow!
Dem zones, dem zones, dem solar zones, dem zones, dem zones, dem solar zones, dem zones, dem zones, dem solar zones, spinning the sun in a dance. Plasma is created in the sun's core. Above the sun's core is the radiative zone. Above the radiative zone is the convective zone, spinning the sun in a dance. Above the convective zone is the photosphere. Above the photosphere is the chromosphere. Above the chromosphere is the corona zone, spinning the sun in a dance. Dem zones, dem zones, dem solar zones, dem zones, dem zones, dem solar zones, dem zones, dem zones, dem solar zones, spinning the sun in a dance.
So, Ryan.
Yes, Pete.
Promises were made. Tell me about the sexy sun ladies.
Okay, well, during the 1960s, the UK was starting to emerge from all that miserable post-war austerity, and they were starting to swing their way into a dawn of cultural renaissance. A new generation of kids are growing up in a world very different to their parents' darker past. They weren't interested in war and death anymore, Pete. They wanted rock and roll, they wanted mini skirts, and they wanted free love, baby.
I get it. I'm in. I'm with them every step of the way.
Yeah. And it was in this time of transformation, Pete, that old and stuffy media institutions found themselves having to adapt or risk being left behind. And one newspaper in particular was really feeling that pressure. Now, first published back in 1912, the Daily Herald had once been the mouthpiece for trade unionists and the labour movement. Not the coolest cats on the block, Pete. And now, in the 1960s, it sort of found itself out of step, you know, with the British public. And thanks to competition from other rival papers like the Daily Mirror and the Daily Express, readership numbers were at an all-time low. So, in an attempt to fix things, the Herald's owner made a decision to rebrand, and on the 15th of September 1964, the Daily Herald became The Sun.
Ah, I like what you're doing here. I see it now. Carry on, sir.
Okay, so, this new paper promised to be a beacon of modernity. Really hooking those young kids. With a captivating blend of hard news, sports, and entertainment.
Well, it sounds familiar.
Right, but despite some initial excitement, as you can imagine, by the end of 19...
turning out in droves. Tell me more about this mix of news and current affairs.
So by the end of 1969, unfortunately, the Sun was selling fewer papers than the Daily Herald, its older version. And so, facing disaster, the publishers decide to put the Sun up for sale. Enter, Pete, the swashbuckling form of an unlikely saviour. Brash Australian media mogul Rupert Murdoch.
Rupert Murdoch?
My hero! Yes, an established publisher at this point. He'd established several successful newspapers like the Daily Mirror, the Australian version, and the Australian, which was the Australian newspaper. Now, ever the entrepreneur, Murdoch wanted to do the same he'd done in Australia over in Great Britain. So he travelled across the world and walked into their offices and bought the Sun newspaper for 800,000 Great British pounds. It's about 10 million pounds today.
The equivalent today is buy two houses with that amount of money, so clearly values have changed.
They have indeed. Now, under his control, Murdoch immediately rebrands the paper. Not the title, he likes the name The Sun, he keeps that, but what he wants to do is change the format. And so he starts to turn it into a mass market tabloid focused on sensational news, political scandals, celebrity gossip, fluff pieces, Pete, all aimed at hooking in as many readers as possible.
Still a big trade union section, though, no?
No.
Right, okay.
He abandoned that bit. Now, at the same time, he deliberately targeted his main rival, which was, in the UK, the Daily Mirror. And he started to steal some of their more successful formats and make them his own, including, most notably, publishing photos of female models wearing lingerie and bikinis. In fact, the nearly naked girls were so successful that Murdoch's editor of The Sun, Larry Lamb, he dedicated a whole page of the paper to publishing photos of a sexy Swedish glamour model called Ulla Lindström.
Ulla is the name a glamour model should have. Ooh la la.
Ooh la la, yeah. Now, Ulla was chosen by Lamb because, well, one, she's very attractive, but also because he knew that she was being featured in that month's edition of the popular soft porn magazine Penthouse. So he was gambling that her popularity in that magazine would bring over a readership to The Sun that were looking for more pictures of her. And he was right, because the images of Ulla in The Sun wearing a suggestively unbuttoned shirt resulted in massive hikes in sales. Now, Lamb did receive a few complaints about this, but he pressed on with the feature, continuing to show scantily clad glamour models on page 3 each day for the entire next year. He branded the girls Page 3 Models, and that was a name that stuck thereafter. Now, side note, Lamb's decision to place these photos on the third page was deliberate. He didn't just pick it at random, right? He wanted to maintain that traditional, respectable front page of a newspaper, but then immediately hook readers the moment they turned the page. That's why they were put on page 3.
This is the sort of formal and organised equivalent of slipping a comic book inside a novel by Dostoevsky. I'm reading a newspaper.
Ooh. Exactly. Oh, look at my hard news.
Oh, is that what's going on in Libya today?
Yes, Pete, it was still a controversial decision. And it did raise some eyebrows, but frankly, The Sun avoided any real criticism at this point. After all, the Daily Mirror was doing it too, so it just kind of, well, it's just another paper doing the same thing. Now, Lamb was mindful of the paper being labelled as pornography, and so he ordered his team to only photograph, in quotes, wholesome, non-vulgar, nice girls.
I genuinely don't know how that is to be interpreted.
Yes. I can only imagine they walked away from that meeting just shrugging and going,
I don't know,
okay.
What does that give her a bow in her hair? I don't know.
Well, clearly some of that sort of passed down to the team, because he even formed a panel of female reporters who worked at The Sun to review and approve each image that was then going to be published. Basically, this was to ensure that they passed the taste standards of an average British woman.
Oh, she seems a trifle unwholesome.
Yeah.
Whereas this lingerie-clad woman seems very much the girl next door.
Oh, vulgar. Vulgar's not a word that's used very much anymore, is it?
No.
Let's bring it back, everyone!
Bring back vulgarity. That's. I'll tweet that and see how that goes for us.
So look, all of this was fine and dandy until the 17th of November 1970, when Lamb took advantage of the fact that Rupert Murdoch was out of the country, when he then decided to push things further. In what was supposed to be a cheeky nod in celebration of the paper's first birthday, he decided to publish a completely nude photo of Singapore-born model Stephanie Rahn. Now, he published this under a headline which described her as wearing her birthday suit. You see what he did there?
Ah, I see. Fully clever.
Very clever.
That is a slim little thread to hang that on.
Now, the image of Stephanie was photographed by the Sun's page 3 photographer, Beverly Goodway. And it showed a picture of Miss Rahn sitting cross-legged in a field, smiling at the camera with one of her breasts fully exposed.
Left or right?
Right. Left. Left.
I was just testing to see if you'd seen this image.
I believe it was the left. I was told. I read somewhere it was the left. Anyway, the public reaction to this, Pete, was huge. Prior to 1970, the Sun's circulation was around 1.2 million copies sold a day. Thanks to that topless photo of Stephanie Rahn on page 3, sales of the newspaper skyrocketed to 2.5 million copies a day. That was more than doubling its circulation.
Wow. Anything happened while I was gone? Yes, boss.
So it was a gamble that paid off, but it also sparked a significant point in the history of British journalism, because to many of the public, the Sun newspaper had been selling itself as a mainstream, family-friendly media outlet, not the place for topless women. And so debates sprang up with arguments for and against. For some people, it was seen as nothing more than a tantalising, guilty pleasure that didn't hurt anyone. But for others, especially those on the conservative side of morality, it was bad taste, plain and simple. It was exploitative, it was degrading, and it contributed to the objectification of women. The Women's Liberation Movement argued that it, quote, portrays women as two-dimensional sexual objects, contributing to a corrosive culture in which the female body is commodified, stripped of deeper humanity, and leered at for mass entertainment and profit. Journalists on other rival papers said that the Sun was lowering long-established standards and embracing the most base elements of human appetite. They called page 3 blind sensationalism and editorially indefensible. Organisations like the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, they called page 3 a disgusting phony excuse for exploiting the female body. Mary Whitehouse, the self-appointed crusader for all things moral in the UK, said that page 3 was demeaning to women and should offend and appall wives and mothers. And in the middle of all of this noise, Peter, is Rupert Murdoch and Larry Lamb, who happily stick to their guns, crossing their arms, unmoved by the complaints, and pointing to the sales figures as proof that there was, out there, a silent majority in the public who wanted page 3 to stick around. In fact, rather than backing down against the pressure, they just dug in. They continued to print images of topless women on page 3 and instead painted themselves as persecuted champions of the people, a liberating force that challenged the repression of political correctness. Murdoch himself said that there was nothing wrong with it at all. He said, "I don't think it's immoral or indecent or anything. Page 3 isn't about featuring topless models. It's about challenging norms and pushing the boundaries of what is socially acceptable."
Yes, he had me in the first half. Then he went to, "It's not about naked women." Very much is about naked women, isn't it? It's because it's a naked woman.
It actually is, yeah. In fact, Murdoch even went so far as to start rolling the page 3 feature out across all of his other worldwide newspapers. That is, except for Australia, where supposedly, out of respect to his mother who lived there, he kept the paper free of nudity. Thoughts on that, Pete?
I have so many thoughts, but I don't think any of them paint me in a good light, actually. So I'm going to say, that was interesting, Ryan. Thank you very much.
Now, as unrepentant as his boss, editor Larry Lamb said, the paper reflects society. And I think the topless shots reflect society's attitudes. Everyone's brain is a little bit bevied with sex. We're just being honest, that's all.
Just saying what everyone thinks.
And to support their argument for free speech, Murdoch and Lamb used the power of their paper to start attacking the critics directly, often calling them prudes and spoil sports. Notably, in 1986, just outside of our time period, a Labour Party politician, Claire Short, she tried to introduce legislation to ban topless models in newspapers, and the Sun responded by launching a humiliating campaign which attacked the politician daily for months, calling her ugly and a killjoy. Do you know what they also did, Pete? They gave out free bumper stickers with a less than flattering image of her face on them.
That does sound like something they would do.
Yeah, they even published a poll asking their readers if they would rather see Claire's face in the paper or the back of a bus.
That is not very nice.
It's not very nice, is it? And so the paper continued to publish images of topless girls on page three for decades, becoming basically a part of the nation's culture, turning glamour models into mainstream celebrities overnight. Models like Kathy Lloyd, Gail McKenna, Katie Price, even Ginger Spice from the Spice Girls, Jerry Halliwell, all started their careers by posing for Page Three.
You are missing the Page Three girl par excellence on whom I grew up, Linda Lusardi.
Linda Lusardi was also another one. If I'd have sat here and gone through all of them, though, Pete, I'll be honest, there's a long list.
I just need to nod to the greats.
But there's one more that I would like to talk about, and that is because this one was startlingly young when she modelled for The Sun. In the 1980s, a 15-year-old girl called Samantha Fox wrote to The Sun newspaper asking to be a Page Three model. And just after her 16th birthday, her wish came true.
That's pretty creepy.
You think? Yeah.
I think it was a different time is the go-to phrase at this point, isn't it?
It was a different time. And you can tell that because her photos were insanely popular with readers. She went on to become arguably the most famous ever Page Three model, becoming the third most photographed British celebrity after Margaret Thatcher and Princess Diana.
Wow. I don't think it's even arguable. Sam Fox was the Page Three girl of all of them.
Now, topless teenage models stopped in 2003, Pete, when the UK's Sexual Offences Act raised the minimum age limit to just 18 years old. But Page Three continued publishing images until The Sun finally called an end to it in 2015, partly because of changes in attitudes towards the objectification of women, which were sort of increasing, but largely due to the amount of free digital pornography that was now becoming increasingly available online.
It doesn't feel like a win, does it?
No. But look, whatever your thoughts on The Sun's Page Three, it's impossible to acknowledge how successful it was. It cemented The Sun's place as Britain's most widely read and influential newspaper for generations of readers. And there you go. In a literal sense, Page Three was a hotspot in The Sun during our time period.
Oh, well, that's an excellent angle, Ryan. You've done well there, although you have failed to mention the feeble attempt to redress the gender balance that was the Page Seven fella.
Didn't last very long, that one.
No, that is on the long list of things I remember from that time going, yeah, that's not going to go.
It did not.
Well, that was excellent, Ryan. Thank you very much. Have you got more stuff?
I do.
Well, let's take a break and come back after this. All right, love, that's it. Push them out a bit more. Yeah, front, lean forwards. There you go. Smashing. Gorgeous. Oh, very sexy. Very sexy.
Oh, thank you, darling. I was just wondering, though, perhaps we could do something that showcases both looks and personality.
Oh, I'm getting great shots of your big, firm personalities.
Well, it's just that we've got this semi-lateral light, right? So I wondered if we could go for something, yeah, more deliberate overexposure.
Just stare into the camera, love.
I mean, with this industrial background, it could create a real powerful contrast of tones, you know? An interesting juxtaposition, don't you think? You know, sort of organic versus mechanical.
Yeah, yeah, just lean over a bit more.
A commentary, you know, on what it means to be human in a post-industrialist society, a sort of post-postmodernism, you might say, hey?
Yeah, whatever. A bit more of a pout, please.
After all, shouldn't we aim for profundity in all aspects of our work?
Yeah, profundity and whatever. Carry on.
And wasn't it Picasso, right, who said art is a lie that makes us realise the truth?
Yeah, art, whatever. Go on, carry on.
I just feel like we could make a difference to the world, yeah? Inspire girls to be greater, more than the sum of their parts. Oh, by the way, is there any more ice? Because my nipples are getting soft.
Okay, Ryan, you've steamed me up with saucy ladies from page 3 of The Sun. What else do you have for me?
I've got horny 18-year-old boys.
I do hope we can take this out of context as an edit and then pop it onto Twitter and have Ryan cancelled immediately. Clarify, Ryan.
So, Greece has many islands.
Okay, that's an open. Let's see where it takes us.
Yeah, around 6,000 of them, in fact, of which 200 are inhabited. One of these is an island called Mykonos.
Ah, yes, indeed it is.
It's located in a small group of islands known as the Cyclades. It's in the Aegean Sea off the southeast coast of mainland Greece, if you want to go there. Short trip from Athens. Now, Mykonos is a small island. It's home to roughly 10,000 people who mostly live in a small town on the west coast. Now, early man was in Mykonos, Pete, around the 11th century BCE. Long, long time ago. And since then, it's been home to the ancient Greeks, the Romans, the Byzantines, the Venetians, and the Ottomans, all of whom have sort of lived this isolated existence on the island in modest fishing and farming villages around the landscape. And that was how it was for thousands of years. A traditional, humble island tied to the rhythms of the sea. But then, the 20th century came knocking.
Yay, let's mix things up.
So in the 1920s, a bunch of archaeologists arrive looking for a roof over their heads while they spend their days digging out treasures on the nearby island of Delos. Now, realising that there was an easy income to be made by giving up their spare bed for the night to a stranger, in 1925, a small group of Mykonians organised for a group of Greek mainlanders to hop on over to the island for a short vacation. These holidaymakers love the place and they return home and they start to spread the word about how lovely Mykonos is. And by the 1930s, the number of visitors to Mykonos has doubled, with travellers lured from across Europe by talk of sandy beaches and crystal blue seas.
Yeah, I'm interested.
Now, by doubled, what I really mean is 20 people a year.
Right, okay. So
not rocking with tourists, no. I've got to say. Anyway, for the next few decades, life carries on. Fishermen catch octopus, farmers herd goats, families gather in village squares, smash plates, and dance to the ancient sound of Zorba. That is, Pete, until the 1960s, when a post-war boom of technology and prosperity and commercial air travel means that more and more people are starting to chill out on holidays in exotic destinations. And jumping on this lucrative trend were Mad Men-style advertisers who started promoting the benefits of travel, focusing on the sun as a symbol of health, with adverts in glossy magazines showing images of beautiful and happy people lying on white sand beaches under the life-giving rays of the sun. A natural tonic, Pete, for improving health and well-being. A claim which was backed by medical professionals who all agreed on the power of sunlight, a free source of vitamin D that can help improve vitality and beauty.
Well, I concur. There's many merits to being in the sun from time to time, with some drawbacks.
And of course, getting a suntan was the perfect way to show people that you know that you live a life of lounging on beaches and you're not one of those boring, poor, pale-skinned people who stay at home doing chores.
Ugh, not them. I hate them.
Me too. Movies, commercials, they all start featuring images of sun-kissed celebrities wearing swimwear on the beach and standing by the pool. Suntans become the ideal of beauty. And so it's no surprise to find that summer vacations to the beach become hugely popular. Coastal towns around the world start booming with tourists. And in this environment lies Mykonos, a quiet island with brilliant blue seas, idyllic beaches, 300 days of sunshine a year, and temperatures that regularly reach 80 degrees Fahrenheit, 32 degrees Celsius, there or thereabouts. The perfect environment for sun worship. Now, at first, a gradual trickle of visitors arrived, sort of weirdo nomads and free-spirited 60s types. But as the decade progressed, more and more people started arriving, to the point where so many tourists needed accommodation that locals just ran out of room for them in their homes, and they had to start converting their fishing huts into hostels. Entrepreneurs opened up bars and restaurants and grocery stores, and eventually, Pete, the once sleepy villages transformed into vibrant party towns. Now, this kind of party town attracts the likes of movie stars and celebrities. We see movie stars like Grace Kelly, Brigitte Bardot, and in the resulting publicity, Mykonos becomes the hotspot destination for tourism.
Oh, I like what you did there.
The island's first gay bar, Pieros, is opened in the early 1970s by handsome Italian gay celebrity Piero Aversa and a local fisherman called Andreas Koutsoukos. That started a trend that saw Mykonos become known as a safe and welcome hub for the gay and LGBTQ plus community, with gay-friendly bars, drag shows and nudist beaches opening all across the island. In the 1970s, major hotel companies start investing heavily, opening luxury properties like the Belvedere Beach Hotel and Cavo Togo, both these huge, sprawling resorts which accommodate like thousands of sunseekers. And on top of that, during peak season, cruise ships start arriving every day, unloading thousands of visitors into this small little town. In fact, where Mykonos once received less than 10,000 tourists a year in the 1960s, by the 1970s, that figure was well over 500,000.
That is a cultural change to live through, isn't it?
In a decade, yeah. So the island starts to become unrecognisable from, you know, its humble origins. There's now electricity, there's running water, there's telephones, there's a network of buses and taxis, there's an airport being built and a port capable of receiving ferries. It's almost hard to imagine, Pete, what it might have been like to have been there at that time and experienced Mykonos during such a period of great transformation. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree.
Well, to help us out with that, I spoke with someone who was there.
Γεια σας. Λέγομαι Νίκος Νικολαίδης. Είμαι πατέρας τριών παιδιών και τεσσάρων εγγονών. Ο μεγαλύτερος είναι 20, ο μικρότερος με τη μικρότερη 14. Θα ήθελα να εξιστορήσω κάποιες ιστορίες όσον αφορά τότε που είχα πάει στη Μυκονό.
So that's the voice, Pete, of Nikos Nikolaidis. He's a father and a grandfather living in Athens who kindly agreed to tell me about his time living on Mykonos during the 1970s. Now, you'll notice that Nikos doesn't speak any English, so I'm going to do my best to translate for him.
Okay, I will trust you, but I will also refer you to my Greek-speaking colleagues to make sure you're not diddling us with your translations.
Fair enough. In 1974, when I was 18 years old, I went to Mykonos Island during the summer season to work as a painter-decorator in the new hotels. I was very young, and when the ship approached the port, I was curious and excited to see what this island was all about. The first thing that I remember seeing was tiny white houses on an island without trees, white and blue. I was very fascinated because the ship couldn't approach the port and little boats had to come and collect the tourists and take them to the island, including me. I remember when I reached the port, I was looking to find my boss, and when I found him, he took us to our accommodation. So there you go. That's him arriving, Pete.
That's the start of an adventure, isn't it? I love that detail of not being able to get all the way in and having to be ferried by tiny boats to get you out. That's great.
The tiny little houses, like it's still transforming. And yet here he is, there to build and construct new hotels. Amazing. He continues from there. From that moment, my adventure had started. I started to explore the island as a young man. The island was full of tourists, walking in the small paths to explore the island's hidden gems. In each and every path, you can find a Greek restaurant, but I was impressed with so many shops selling jewellery, and I wondered why so many existed here. Later, I understood that cruise ships with older retired American tourists would come and buy all the jewellery.
Και κατεβαίναν και ψωνίζανε οι άνθρωποι. Ήταν μεγάλοι άνθρωποι όλοι αυτοί οι Αμερικανοί.
These were all retired Americans who came with load of money. He told me that apparently they literally sold out. Like when these people came in, it was like locusts. They just bought everything.
Right, that's amazing.
He continues from there, Pete. Our work schedule was a bit of a mess, but we'd work during the weekdays, and after work we used to go to the beach and get ready for the bars. I will never forget the first time I went to Super Paradise Beach. That was a nudist beach. We used to approach the beach on small boats. I met many other boys like myself who were working on the island, and together we went to the beach. I'll never forget the naked bodies that I saw sunbathing in Super Paradise Beach. I couldn't stop laughing with my friends. I was telling my friends to stop laughing or they're going to kick us out. Then we got used to this nudist image and we became one of them. But still, it was very strange for us. The water was so beautiful. The blue sky reflecting in the crystal clear sea and the atmosphere was so beautiful. This island was amazing. It was the best in Greece when it comes to the beach and the scenery. So how about that, Pete? Your first trip as an 18-year-old boy to a nudist beach.
I mean, it would sear itself in your memory, wouldn't it? But I like the way he ended with, and I really love the scenery. He's like, yes, evidently.
He went on from there, Pete. Then, at night, after the beach, we used to start our entertainment in two of the best bars on the island, the very famous Pieros and Nine Muses, owned by a famous Greek fashion designer called Galatis. He was one of the most important people on the island and made Mykonos what it is today. Both owners were fashion designers and would bring celebrities with them to the island. In the bars, there was chaos, especially in Pieros, where he was known internationally as a fashion designer. So there you go. You have two bars, both opened by gay fashion designers, bringing celebrities to the island. Famous, fashionable, attractive people all drinking and hanging out in these bars.
Oh, this is, I mean, it's the story of Croydon all over again, isn't it?
No. Now, he talks a little bit more about this. That time, there was also a bar owned by a famous Greek singer that only had lesbian women. Again, 65% of the island was the gay community, but it was mixed. We were all together having fun. I remember there was one bar with a German dancer dressed as a woman who would give a striptease, and the show he would give, I don't remember his name, but at that time, in 1974, he was ahead of his time. Because drag shows like his can be found today all around the world.
There you go, trendsetters. That is amazing. I can only 65% gay community at that time as well. Must have been just so liberating to be not have to conceal yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah, he goes on. I remember that it was full of mixed nationalities. Norway, Canada, New Zealand, Sweden, Italy, Germany, but the majority were from Scandinavia. Their money had the bigger value than our money. The French franc and the German Deutschmark meant that they could have a lot of fun at a very low price because we needed to work to afford this kind of entertainment. The local people were very conservative, but they loved the money from the tourists. Even though I didn't have interest in business on the island and was only there to have fun with the girls, I was still able to see how much money was being passed around.
Yes, it's amazing how flexible my morals become when a large bucket of money is thrown in my direction.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, though, isn't it? The idea of you a decade ago just herding your goats around and then suddenly here's 65% of everybody's
gay
doing
fashion
drag
designers.
Shows and celebrities hanging around. Bonkers. He carries on, though, Pete. Today, Mykonos is not like it used to be. That time, it was more pure. No matter if they were gay or straight on the island, people were just different. Nowadays, you will see many business people owning villas, and they pretend that they are something they are not, and they've changed the feeling of the island. In those days, it was pure and true. It was a great period for the island that allowed even for middle-class people to spend time on the island and have some fun. Now, only wealthy people can afford to visit. Celebrities wanted to visit and leave the island as they found it, but now the wealthy want to change it into their own image.
Well, that's a story as old as time, that one, isn't it? Becomes amazing and fantastic and everyone wants to be there, and suddenly all the things that made it amazing and fantastic get priced out. It's gentrification in Holiday Island form.
It really is. I'll leave Nick the Greek to finish off with his final thoughts. I can only say that it was the best time of my life. I went to the island to work for 2 or 3 months, and I ended up staying for 10 to 11 months. And the only reason that I left was because I received the government letter to join the army. Again, I will repeat, it was so beautiful, the best time of my life. I wish I could go back again and live those same moments. The people that I met, the friendships that I made, the beautiful island, everything was just perfect. I wish that everyone could have had this kind of experience once in their lifetime. Many people from my neighbourhood, my city, they came to the island to work for a season. And nowadays, today, when we get together in coffee shops, we are still talking about our experiences on Mykonos.
Oh, so there you go. Love it. That is a classic formative experience. Imagine that idyllic summer in your youth, things changing, the freedom. Oh, it feels like a movie ready to be made.
I want to go. It sounds amazing.
Oh, me too. Well, a huge thanks to Nick the Greek.
Nick the Greek providing proof, positive evidence that Mykonos was indeed a hot spot in the sun during 1957 to 1975.
Nicely done, sir.
We are now entering the harbour of Mykonos, a popular summer resort for Athenians and a stopover point for foreign visitors who make the regular cruise of the central Aegean islands. Aside from the people of Mykonos, what impresses visitors most are the houses you see here. Always pure white, as though freshly whitewashed this morning. After a walk around the town, which includes climbing of steep hills, it is a pleasure to sit for a while over coffee and cake and to watch a very strange performance. This is not exactly a traditional folk dance, but a very special talent by an enterprising young man. It is an exhibition of strength, skill, and grace.
Well, Ryan, I enjoyed that enormously. I thought you brought it home. We were in space for a bit. We were back on Earth for a bit. It was sciencey. It was historic. It was free-spirited summer of love. I enjoyed it very, very much. But it is time to move on to the next episode. This is a relentless march of progress in this, on this
cursed podcast.
We've got to keep going. You've got to keep going. So it's time to derselate the next episode. It's my go for episode 88.
Let's do it. I'm going to wheel it out. Here we go. I'm going to switch it on. All right. Okay, Peter, are you ready?
88 is a very lucky number, so I'm expecting big things.
Okay, well, let's find out. Your place is... Well, you said big things. It's China.
Ah, I love the Chinese. They're always writing things down and storing them for later.
That is true. Yeah. Let's hope it's not a million years ago or something. Okay, your time period is... 100 to 200.
100. Ooh, I genuinely don't know if that's...
Yeah.
Ooh, okay. That's tight, okay.
Isn't it? Maybe stuff was written down.
Oh, let's hope so.
And your topic is... Nutrition.
Nutrition. Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. That's okay, isn't it? That sounds all right.
I think I can do something with that. I mean, they had to have been eating something, right? So,
Rice. Fish. Probably.
I can do something. I can do something. I will come back with something good, I promise.
You better do, Pete, because you have got nutrition in China during the years 100 to 200. Good luck, pal.
I will not let you down, don't worry. And that's it with that desolation. That's it for the show for this week. Thank you so much for listening. As ever, if you'd like to get in touch about any of the things we've talked about on the show, or if you just want to say hi, you can reach out to us through the website at hhepodcast.com or email Pete and Ryan at hhepodcast.com.
That's right. We would love to hear from you. And you never know, you might end up featured on a future show.
Such as Rongosaurus, who very kindly left us a review saying it's a great podcast to listen to whilst walking or doing DIY. Highly recommended. And also says there's something for everyone. So if you are one of everyone, you'll enjoy the show. Tell your friends.
If you are on Mastodon, Instagram, Facebook or X, you can find us at HHE Podcast.
Indeedy. And if you subscribe to those, you'll get an alert when we post extra content, facts, pictures, photos and other bits and pieces.
That's right.
And of course, we'll be back again soon with
The Verdict.
But until then, a huge thanks to you, Ryan.
And a huge thanks to Nikos.
Absolutely. Thanks, Nikos. And that's it. I guess all that's left to say is
you have been listening to
History Happened Everywhere.
Hey, Ryan.
Oh, hey, Pete.
What have you done to my shirt?
What do you mean?
There's a hole burned right in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and?
Well, I was doing the ironing.
Go on.
And, well, I got distracted. And I may have left the iron on the shirt for too long.
Oh, I knew it. Look at it. You've ruined it now.
Ruined? No. If anything, it's better now.
Better how exactly?
Well, it's got a hot spot.
A hot spot?
Yeah. It focuses attention away from the rest of you. When you wear it, people will look through the hole, see your six-pack, think you're sexy, and then ask for your phone number. I call it a hot spot.
But I don't have a six-pack, Ryan.
Well, that's not my fault. You should take better care of yourself.
Oh, Ryan, you're an idiot. I just want this shirt replaced.
Fine.
Now, where's the rest of my laundry anyway?
Ah, well, your hot spuddies are in the wardrobe with your hot spants, and your hot spocks are in the drawer with your hot spoxes.
Ryan, have you ruined all my clothes?
Yes. Yes, I have.
Gah!